You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 26, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Robert Cruikshank, blogger at Calitix, and on his post at the Daily Kos about coalition politics in the progressive movement. Quite a bit of news for you today. A lot of whining on the right about Medicare. We will get to that later in the program. Also, John Edwards back in the news. A resolution of my prophecy yesterday on Chrysler. And this is pretty hilarious. We don't have much time here. Okay, so let me get to this story here. This is from Talking Points memo. Apparently, the Tea Party Patriots, which is a Georgia-based organization that counts around 1,000 chapters nationwide, is asking its members to pressure their local school boards to teach the Constitution during a Constitution Week. Well, you know what? I applaud that measure. There was a recent study that showed that we are not teaching civics to our students, eighth graders, fourth graders, whatever it is, sufficiently at all. We have a generation, and maybe some generations, of students who are graduating without a sense of what the Constitution says, without a sense of what it means to be a good citizen. So I applaud the Tea Party Patriots for trying to get schools to teach the Constitution. Oh, what's this? Oh. And when schools do teach the founding document, the group is suggesting that they use materials provided by the National Center for Constitutional Studies. Oh, well, that sounds okay. A group that claims the country and Constitution were established by the hand of God. The Bible-tution, folks. The NCCS's founder, Cleon Skuzin, became a Tea Party favorite in recent years when Glenn Beck touted him on his program as an exemplary constitutional scholar. Princeton historian Sean Willens described one of Skuzin's books, The 5,000-Year Leap, as, quote, a treatise that assembles selective quotations and groundless assertions to claim that the U.S. Constitution is rooted not in the Enlightenment, but in the Bible. And I have had firsthand experience in dealing with these type of Tea Party, Glenn Beck, visions of the Constitution. A year ago, almost in August, 8/28, I was at the Bibletution rally. Oh, I guess it was Restoring Honor. I'm not sure. With Glenn Beck. This is from the YouTube that I posted. This interview, as you can see, is completely unedited exchange with a woman who was at the rally. Let's play that now.
What does Restoring Honor mean to you?
Restoring Honor, I guess, means trying to go back to live the actual Constitution. You know, there doesn't need to be a separation of God and church. You know, I think that a lot of our problems have to do with taking God out of the schools and, you know, separating it all.
But from a constitutional standpoint, isn't there supposed to be separation of church and state?
Well, I need to take a Constitution class. I will admit that. I have signed up for one starting in October, so I can learn more. I don't admit to knowing everything about the Constitution, but I don't feel that our country is going in the direction that it was meant to. And I do not like health care. I like to see that repealed.
Let me ask you about, because you're here, you feel like we've gotten...
We don't need to hear anymore. So there you have it, folks. That is the issue there. She has traveled. She don't admit to knowing too much about the Constitution, but she did admit to traveling nearly 100 miles to protest that we're not living the actual Constitution when she will be aware of it in the month and a half when she decides to take that Constitution course. Following that, I asked her, well, what happens if you take that Constitution course and find out that there's stuff in there you don't like? And she's like, I really don't know. And my guess is that, in fact, she won't find anything in there that she don't like. Particularly if the Tea Party has a say in it. Because we all know that God reached down, picked up a quill pen.
Hey guys, I know I haven't been around for 1,800 years or so, 1,776 years. I've been busy, but I figured I'd drop in just to write this up. Why'd I wait 1,776 years for this? I was waiting for you to invent quill pens. Okay, go back to it. Just put some type of seal on there. Tell everybody I wrote this. Okay, bye-bye.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. We'll be right back with Robert Cruikshank. All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the Skype device. In fact, I think I can hear him typing as we speak. Robert Cruikshank, he is a progressive activist and communication specialist. He posts regularly at Calitix. Welcome to the program, Robert.
Thanks for having me on, Sam.
So, Robert, I saw a great piece that you had posted at Daily Kos. And it was entitled, Why Are Progressives as Good at Politics as Conservatives? Now, this has been an extended debate, I think, that has existed online, at least, and probably even prior to that, in progressive politics. But you start off, but your take on it is a little bit different. It is less about messaging, which we have heard for years, and more about the relationship between the different coalitions in the progressive movement. And you cite the controversy around Cornel West's very scathing criticism of President Obama, which we've discussed on this program. But take it from there. What is the main thesis of your argument?
Well, I'd say the main thesis is that there are two coalitions within the Democratic Party. There's the Progressive Coalition. There's the what we might call the neoliberal coalition, the centrist coalition, the Blue Dog Democrats, for example. And the struggle we've had as progressives is how do we get along? How do we ensure that within the Democratic Party, it's the progressive viewpoint that wins out? Because that other side within our party, the centrist wing, the corporate wing, the neoliberal wing, constantly drives things that are antithetical to our agenda. And what I started to figure out is the problem is really within the progressive movement itself. We don't act as effectively as we can, as we should, partly because we don't do as good a job of standing up for each other. This has started to change this year, but there are two examples, I think, that show the direction we need to go. When Planned Parenthood came under attack, people started to rally behind them and make sure they got their funding. That's part of it. When unions in Wisconsin came under attack, other progressive groups came together to help them out as well. That's how you build a strong movement, by making sure everyone else has each other's back. That's how you start getting messages that people are willing to share. That's how you get a movement where people stand together instead of, you know, all these different issue silos or movement silos.
You know, it's interesting. Because I want to get back to the union thing. But before we get to that, give me some examples. And I just off the top of my head, I can think of a couple. But some examples of when we have seen progressives not do that.
Well, I think the healthcare debate in 2009 was a particularly strong one. You know, there are a lot of different people with interests in there. A lot of people, myself included, wanted a strong role for government in providing healthcare. We wanted a public option at minimum. That was sort of our minimum level of compromise. Most of us wanted a straight up single payer system. Now, to have a good compromise for a movement to continue, for a coalition to be strong, everyone needs to get something out of that coalition. So people who wanted a strong role for government should have gotten a public option. Instead, they got sold out and said, no, you can't have that. When that happens, that weakens a coalition. Someone walks into a movement and says, we need this. We need to get something out of it. And you don't give it to them, that's a problem. Healthcare shows another, I think, even bigger problem with unions, and it comes back there.
Well, wait a second. I want to stop you there, because it seems to me that your argument is that we, within the context of the Democratic Party, there's two wings. Within one of those wings, we need to have more solidarity, that being the progressive wing of that party.
Yes.
What elements in the context of the progressive wing? Because my sense was that the battle of over the public option and the single payer was between the progressive wing of the party and the neoliberal wing of the party. Is that not correct? I mean, was your sense that there were elements within the progressive wing of the party that were not on board with fighting for that public option?
Yeah, I think that's true. When I was still in California, I worked with a group called the Courage Campaign. We were actively pushing our senators, Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, to support a public option. We eventually were able to do that. But there are a lot of other progressives who just didn't think that was the right move. They thought that, well, we're not going to get a public option. It's not worth fighting for a public option. So let's just take whatever we can get from the Obama administration and defend that. The problem was, as the healthcare bill evolved, a lot of other progressive groups lost. Unions were facing attacks on healthcare benefits. And that, of course, as we know, helped lead to the victory of Scott Brown in the Massachusetts special election in 2010. That's an example of where a coalition breaks down because people start turning on each other instead of saying, okay, we need to help the unions out, we need to help the people who support a public option out, and, of course, we need to help the people who are concerned about abortion rights. Now, in a good, strong movement, those things overlap, right? It's not that one person only cares about abortion rights and doesn't care about the other things. But you need to build from that shared set of values a strong movement by making sure every piece of it is taken care of.
So, I mean, if we had a situation where the public option, for some reason, was a would necessarily hurt unions. It wouldn't have, but I'm just using this as a hypothetical. That creates a wedge. That becomes a wedge issue, doesn't it, on some level? But in this instance, we had no there was nobody who was going to lose from a public option in terms of it in and of itself, aside from what it might have done to the viability of the Affordable Care Act. There was no price to be paid within the progressive movement if the public option was included.
Well, that's exactly right, and that goes to another of the points I was making, is a good coalition works not only by giving each member some of what they want. You know, sometimes you can't always give people what they want, but what you can do is make sure they don't have to sacrifice anything. And the right is usually very good at doing this. We're not as good. Even progressives sometimes tell each other, well, you might have to take a loss here. That weakens a coalition, you know, and if we're going to overcome the other side, the neoliberal wing, we've got to make sure we're not doing that within the progressive movement. Every single person who considers themselves part of the progressive movement is getting either a victory, or that we make sure they don't take any losses, so that we are as strong as we can be, as united as we can be when facing other people within our own party who want to undermine our goals and our values.
You know, it's interesting because I don't know if you caught that Kevin Drum piece a while back. I think it was Plutocracy Now. And he outlines when the major cleave between the union movement and the liberals took place in the late 60s, when the liberal progressive movement, however you want to define it at that time, became more oriented towards social issues as opposed to economic ones. And so you had union guys going, I'm not hanging out with those hippie fags, and the hippies, I guess, or the social progressive saying, like, you know, these union guys are a bunch of racists. And that cleavage began there, and the Democratic Party began to lessen its support for unions. It weakened unions, which was a huge base of support for progressives. I mean, on some level, and I think it's quite possible that there is still something to that divide, that the, you know, what we hear, the so-called Reagan Democrats, who might be less inclined, or certainly 30 years ago, be forceful in looking for women's rights, gay rights, black rights, minority rights, whatever it is, that gap has sort of closed over years, just as, I guess, unions have gotten weaker and as people have become just more, I guess, open-minded. Do you have a sense that has been a problem in that coalition building?
I think that's been part of the problem. I read Kevin Drum's piece, and I think he's simplifying the history a bit, but I think that cleavage was there. You know, I think one of the reasons that's actually closing now is because we're all being thrown into the same economic pit of despair, you might call it. You know, looking back in the 1960s, 1970s, a lot of those union members thought, well, we have a perfectly good middle-class life. You know, you crazy new left radicals want to go blow all that up. And on top of that, you want to go blow it up with all these social values that we reject. There was a lot of difference there. Now we're in a place where, as the nation becomes more diverse, and as especially younger Americans are much more accepting of that diversity, more importantly, as the class war is increasingly being won by the elite, union members and other people who aren't in a union but who, you know, work for a living, they're all finding ourselves in the same mess. We all find ourselves facing the same problems, the same lack of jobs, lack of wage growth, high debt. And I think that actually makes it possible to close those gaps that have opened over time, because we all realize that if we, you know, don't join together, then we're going to basically starve separately.
Is there any value to, or is it destructive to, in any way prioritize certain types of issues within these coalitions that we're building, or is that problematic?
Well, I think that's part of how a coalition works, and that has to be, you know, negotiated among the members, and that's, in some sense, a formal negotiation among organizations that might be sitting down in Washington, D.C., or Sacramento, or wherever you are. but also within, you know, the rank and file, the membership people debating it, whether it's in person, on a website, on a radio show, you know, a coalition has to sit down and figure out what its priorities are. But part of that is saying, okay, we might prioritize, for example, helping unions out and fighting off Scott Walker in Wisconsin. But everyone who joins that fight needs to have, I think, a reasonable expectation that everyone in that fight will come and help them out too. That they'll all turn to make sure Planned Parenthood gets funded. That they'll all help make sure that we do something about the 99ers, the people who've been unemployed for a long period of time and whose benefits are being exhausted. We don't do as good a job of that. And I think that's a real problem. We ask people to stand up for us, you know, in one part of the coalition, but we don't help them out. I think the what happened to Acorn a year or so ago was a perfect example. You know, not enough progressives came to their defense, and we lost an important part of the movement.
Yeah, that was the first thing that came to mind as you were saying, you know, when I had asked for examples. Acorn was a big one. I mean, I think to a certain extent, there wasn't a broad awareness of Acorn as an entity in some corners. I mean, I was certainly not as familiar with it as it certainly seemed like people like Breitbart were, for that matter. But I think we lost a there did seem to be, once it was clear they were under intense attack, there just seemed to be people just sort of standing by and watching in some way. And so let me get back to what sort of launched your piece, this the controversy surrounding Cornel West. In your model, what should have been the response to what Cornel West had to say?
Well, I think the response is to say that the problem lies with President Obama. Obama has his own coalition. It largely overlaps the Democratic coalition. But Obama has made it quite clear that there's a pecking order in that coalition, and that progressives and even people on the left of the progressive movement, like Cornel West, are essentially expendable. Obama feels that it's more important for him to aggressively seek out so-called centrist independent voters, which is not necessarily the same thing, but it's more important to keep them happy than it is to keep the progressives happy. He basically thinks that progressive voters have nowhere else to go, that when it comes time for re-election, we're all going to fall right in line behind Obama, and I think we probably will. There's a lot of political logic to doing that. But what that means is he takes us for granted. And I think Cornel West is expressing his frustration with that. A lot of other people have expressed frustration in other ways. You know, I think the response is to say, look, Obama is doing this to the progressive movement because we let him, because we don't act as strong or as united a movement as we can. Now, this obviously sometimes leads people to the question of a primary challenge. I don't think that's as useful as figuring out how we as a movement can stick together, impose our own discipline amongst ourselves, and then go to someone like Obama and say, look, we are a united movement. We're not going to let you pick one piece of us off to keep the rest of us happy.
So, if I can hear what you're saying in this instance, is that from a progressive standpoint, regardless of, and tell me if I'm oversimplifying this or misstating your sense of this, but from a progressive standpoint, if you want to strengthen the progressive coalition within the broader coalition of the Democratic Party, let's say, or even outside of it, the proper response at that point is not to be attacking Cornel West because he didn't like the fact because maybe it was inartful or whatever it was. The point is, you got to stand behind this person because at the end of the day, this is a battle that this is an interscene struggle on some level. And Cornel West, from a progressive standpoint, is far more on our side than President Obama is.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think that's oversimplifying at all. I think you can criticize the words West chose. I think that's fair. But Cornel West is part of the progressive movement. He shares most of our values. And I think it's a question of, you know, why does he feel that way? Right? How can we make sure that his needs are getting met, that he's not seeing loss after loss? It's always reasonable to have discussion about the language that's used, but in the end, you know, we need to stand with him.
Well, I think it's a really interesting piece, and is this still in terms of trying to execute this vision? Are we still in that sort of stage where it's really just one where this argument needs to be made and made over and over again? I mean, there's obviously, I don't really have a sense of how it is that you implement this type of vision without it really basically being just you need to convert people to the argument in and of itself.
Well, it's partly the argument, so partly practice. You know, we are seeing around the country progressive coalitions come together. I gave Wisconsin as a good example. I gave the fight to help keep Planned Parenthood funded as another example. It emerges through things like that. People come together in a moment, in a crisis, in a cause. Well, we need to have a promise to everyone who's participating in that coalition that we're going to look after you next. And we need to follow through on that. And once that happens, once people see this movement working in practice, people standing up for each other, that builds its own momentum. And I think that's how the right got to where it is today. We can get there, too, if we start that practice.
Yeah, I have to say that one of the most impressive aspects of what was happening in Madison to me was that it started with teachers' assistants at University of Madison. You know, the and ended up with cops and firefighters who weren't even subject to these bills. And that is a pretty wide economic and psychographic spectrum there in some respects. You know, the university types and the cops and the firemen. That's a pretty broad coalition, and that was one of the most hopeful aspects to what was going on there for me. So in the end, I think we're advocating a little bit more of a knee-jerk response when it comes to protecting those who share a progressive vision.
That's right, because if we don't protect each other, no one else will.
All right, Robert Cruickshank, thanks so much for joining us. You can check out more of Robert's work at Calitix. And what's your Twitter handle, Robert?
Cruickshank, at Cruickshank.
There you have it. And you can see that we'll post that on majority.fm. Thanks so much for joining us, Robert.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, we've got to take a break, folks. We will be back in just a moment. I have many more stories for you. And yes, I will say the S word coming up in this program.
And then we'll suspend you.
You know, the funny thing is, I said it literally like 20 times yesterday. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Forget what it was.
All right, folks. You know, I was debating even talking about this because in the final analysis, there are more important things and we have limited time on this program. But it's interesting and just coincidentally. Well, all right, let me play this clip from Ed Schultz on Tuesday. Maybe it was Tuesday. Maybe it was Tuesday. Yes, on Ed Schultz's radio program. Here it is. Hold on.
I mean, we're in this severe weather pattern right now. Rain, severe thunderstorms, winds getting whipped up to tornadoes of horrific proportions, hot weather, all of this stuff. And what are the Republicans thinking about? They're not thinking about their next door neighbor. They're just thinking about how much this is going to cost. President Obama is going to be visiting Joplin, Missouri on Sunday. But you know what they're talking about? Like this right-wing slut, what's her name, Laura Ingraham? Yeah, she's a talk slut. You see, she was, back in the day, praising President Reagan when he was drinking a beer overseas, but now that Obama's doing it, they're working him over.
Now, I don't know that I've ever referred to a woman as a slut, not in irony. I mean, it's just I don't know. I mean, I'm not that much younger than Ed Schultz. It's just that, or maybe it's just, I don't know. And I'm frankly not clear in what context he's calling her. I mean, you know, when Randy Rhodes did her comedy show and said Hillary Clinton is a whore, she immediately explained what she was saying. She said Hillary Clinton's a whore because she is using, I think it was, I'm paraphrasing here, but she's refusing to, she is threatening to use, you know, she'll use anything, including the convention to get her way or whatever it was. My point is that she clearly wasn't talking about Hillary Clinton from a sexual standpoint. She was talking about her, what she was doing politically. I have gone on air, never mind in a comedy club, and said Joe Lieberman is a whore. And I will say it again and again. And that doesn't mean that I think Joe Lieberman sells himself for sex. I want to make that explicitly clear. I am not accusing Joe Lieberman of selling himself for sex. I'm accusing him for selling himself as a political entity to certain industries. Yesterday on this program, when I was characterizing the argument of the right wingers when it comes to abortion, that they perceive all women as slutty sluts, slut sluts. I don't think I've ever said, oh, that woman is a slut. I don't know, maybe when I was in junior high or something. And I don't know that he's, you know, he said she's a talk slut. Now, it may be an artful, but I don't know. He went on to apologize for it for about like 8 minutes before his show. He's been suspended for a week from his MSNBC show. That's, you know, look, when Imus was suspended or fired, I guess it was, he was fired. It's a function of the company feeling it's inappropriate and getting pushback from their sponsors. Are there situations where a company needs to, I think, has an obligation to stand behind people? Yes, if it's a political issue. But this wasn't a political issue. This was about, this had to do with sort of just the appropriateness of the language. So I think, you know, MSNBC is perfectly within their rights. I think Ed went in there and basically offered up a suspension right off the bat. He was smart to go in and you know, sort of quash this thing before it grew. But in the main, I personally don't like there to be words that are verboten. And we've had this conversation. You know, I've told you that back in the day when we were talking about Macaca on radio, I used the word nigger. And you know, some of the IMers, I think it was M Happy Now, reminded me of, you know, the call that I received from, I think she was an elderly black woman, and I think she was elderly. If she wasn't, my apologies. But, and she was really offended when she heard that word. And I can respect that. But I also think that as a comedian, by training, as a professional talker, I think that words in and of themselves, the words are empty vessels that we infuse with meaning. And it is the context and the intent that, to me, is most important when we use language. I mean, I've told this story about when Nikki wouldn't allow Mila to say the word damn. And I was like, really? But you can't, you know. First of all, I didn't say that in front of Mila. And it's almost, I mean, let me put it this way. The word really in that context said to my wife is just about the worst thing I could have said. But there's nothing intrinsically wrong with the word really. And so, you know, of course, I don't have any say in that. And when Mila said damn, I would say, do not say that word, because I, you know, what are you supposed to do? I'm not going to get my ass kicked by my wife. But the proudest day in as a parent that I've had, perhaps, was when Mila came up to me and just looked at me and started going, flam it, sam it, sham it, cam it, cram it, tam it, lam it. And I just looked at her and I go, you're absolutely right. It's completely random. There's no reason why the syllable d, as opposed to the syllable l, makes that the rest of that word one that you're going to get punished for, or just a look of confusion on my face. So, and if you don't appreciate what I'm saying, frack you. That's another great thing about that that show. So that's that. Let's get I'll give you a little more news on here, because I want to talk about the Medicare. Bunch of sound here from the Medicare stuff. First off, let me start by saying this, that the Harry Reid finally brought the Paul Ryan budget, Medicare destroying budget, to a vote in the Senate. They knew this was going to lose, but they basically want to put everybody on record. People call it theater. I got news for you. That's what politics is. And there's nothing theatrical about this whatsoever. If I'm a voter and I go into the booth, it's a very specific, this could be one of the biggest questions I have. Do you want to destroy Medicare or not? And so I'm glad this isn't about theater. This is about democracy, as far as I'm concerned. They knew it was going to lose. So what? So what? Can you guys, either one of you guys, tell me right now which Republican voted against this plan without looking at it?
Wait, I think I know.
Some. Did you look?
I did not look just now. I did.
Right, but my point is, I wouldn't have guessed. I knew Scott Brown wasn't going to vote for it. Olympia Snow, Susan Collins voted against it. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Rand Paul of Kentucky, because it didn't go far enough in destroying everything. And then Scott Brown, of course, you know, cries about it. It's not right to make me go on the record. And then, and let me make something clear here. All right. I mentioned to you the other day that, and I think I did mention on the member show, that after I did Radigan the other day, hosted by Matt Miller, he stopped me and he said, hey, I heard you took issue with a piece I wrote on Social Security, which was from February. So apparently he heard about it, which I quite enjoyed. And he's like, I'd like to talk to you about it. I said, you come on my show. That'd be great. So he said, yeah, give me your email. So I gave my email through the producer. And he put me on a mailing list. So I got his latest article. And now I don't know which one to have him on for. I got to read this thing again carefully, but he's saying, wait, Paul Ryan has a point. And I'm not sure exactly, frankly, what he thinks that point is by the piece. But he ends it by saying, far-sighted Democrats shouldn't trash the idea of seeking serious savings from Medicare. There's nobody who's not talking about seeking savings from Medicare. I have two articles that were printed today about how you can seek savings from Medicare. I got one word for you, two words for you, death panels. Death panels. Death panels. There was a measure in the Affordable Care Act, and then there was an attempt to do it through regulation to create a cost-effectiveness board. And it was completely demagogued and destroyed by the Republicans. There are plenty of proposals in which you can save money in Medicare. But that savings in Medicare, understand, Medicare runs exactly as efficiently as possible. The savings don't come from Medicare. The savings don't come from the implementation of a government-sponsored health insurance program, which is what Medicare is. The savings come from dealing with the delivery of medicine. And how do you impact the delivery of medicine? Well, if you have an advisory board that looks at the cost effectiveness of each medical measure that is taken, and they can say, we will reimburse at this rate because we have done studies and shown that this is ineffective. That the only reason why the doctor is giving you a full body MRI in this instance is because he owns the MRI machine. This has been shown by that Atul Gawande piece in the New Yorker when he compared two towns in Texas. Everything was controlled. Same type of population. Same health outcomes. One paid 30% more in healthcare costs via Medicare than the other. And the reason is because there were more doctors in that town who owned MRI machines or other machines that they get fee-based medical care they give. And so that's not Paul Ryan's point. And Matt Miller outlines it. Paul Ryan's plan to reduce Medicare costs is to make not a board of 12 or 20 experts at determining cost effectiveness, getting studies, looking at the statistics, and finding out which medical procedure is effective and which is not, which is a waste of time, which is not, which is a doctor basically, you know, I've got a hammer, so everything's a nail. No, Paul Ryan's plan is, give seniors one-third the amount that they need to pay for their health care. Let them choose. Because we know that everyone who hits the age of 65 knows exactly what's best for them from a doctor's care. Right? It's absurd. The issue isn't whether or not we need to lessen the cost of health care. There's no liberal who disagrees with that premise. The issue is how we go about it. I can't even buy a freaking TV and know which one I'm going to buy. You're telling me that it's going to be my responsibility to make an informed decision about what to do if, you know, I've got blood in my stool? Excuse me? I got a cramp in my stomach. I don't know what it is. This is absurd. I think, you know, and I'll have Matt on to talk about his Social Security thing. I don't know if this is just like he writes this stuff because he's contrarian or, you know, maybe it sells. Maybe it's more of a business decision on his part. I don't know. But this is absurd. Paul Ryan's point is not that, hey, I've found a clever way of reducing the cost of Medicare. Paul Ryan's point is there shouldn't be Medicare. Because if there was any intellectual honesty about how to cut costs for Medicare, it would be the same argument as to how to cut costs in the for private insurance, which is we need to restructure the way healthcare is delivered. And we don't have the apparatus to do that in the private sector. We do have the apparatus to do it in Medicare. And that is to have a cost effectiveness board that really looks at this stuff. But then you're going to hear the entire Republican Party take their talking points from Sarah Palin on Facebook. Right here, you know, Ezra Klein. Outlines the three different options on how you can lower costs. One option, which every other developed nation employs, is to simply use the blunt force of government purchasing power to set low prices. In other words, if you have a single payer, or if you're providing prescription, you know, Medicare D prescription coverage, and you have the ability to buy a bucket load of this stuff, price drops. We don't do that in this country, because that's contrary to the market. Although it isn't contrary to the market if I was in the private industry. If I was buying 5,000 reams of paper, it would be much cheaper than what I buy now. The Ryan plan is another option, which is to basically just say, like, we're going to price people out of care. Just not going to give them enough money to buy a lot of health insurance, health care. And so maybe the price will come down. They'll die or live in pain. But then he goes on to say basically the best option is finding savings in the healthcare system itself. The best estimates suggest that 1/5 and 1/3 to 1/3 of all our care is wasted, but figuring out which treatments are helpful and which are hurting is easier than done. Another piece in, I think it's in the Times, by a doctor, Rita Fredberg, goes through some of those things that are wasteful things. Apparently, there's no point in treating prostate cancer at age 75, because if you haven't gotten it before then, prostate cancer takes a long time to kill you, and anything you would do to stop it would be more problematic for you at age 75. And if you haven't, if it's not rapidly moving at that point, apparently everybody dies. If you're 75 or older, everybody dies with prostate cancer. Just most people don't die from it. And so, yes, she concludes, we need a task force recommendation that suggests which things should be reimbursed and which not. But we can't have that task force have the ability to actually implement these things because it's too politically, because we get death panels. That's why. We get morons in the Republican Party who say death panels. So if Matt Miller is going to write his piece, it should not be, hey, wait a minute, Paul Ryan has a point. It should be, hey, wait a minute. If Paul Ryan really believes in what he's saying, then he should turn around and start chastising his party for acting like a bunch of four-year-olds. All right, I'll get to a couple more stories in the post show. Oh, and I've got to say, I'll say it now. I talked to you yesterday about Chrysler. Oh, and tomorrow I'll talk about Scarborough, because his douchebaggery is, and I mean that in a nice way. When I say douchebag, I'm not talking about a douchebag in the literal sense. This douchebaggery is eternal. It's evergreen. But yesterday I mentioned that Chrysler was going to pay back its loan 6 years early. Why isn't President Obama out there touting this? Did I not say that yesterday? Well, guess who gets a cookie today? Me, and it's a metaphorical cookie because I'm actually on a diet. Like, literally, I'm on a diet. Like, no ice cream, no cake, no cookies. I know what you're thinking. Like, well, that's a diet. Yeah, I got to cut those out of my diet. Like, literally, I have to make an effort to do that because my daughter constantly. Today, Detroit News, Washington Bureau, President Barack Obama will visit Chrysler plant in Toledo next week to hail the Auburn Hills automaker's repayment of its $1 billion auto bailout loan. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Is he listening to this show? I certainly hope not, because he certainly has the money to become a member. Unless he's done it under a pseudonym, I haven't seen him join yet. The rest of you, you should join. Oh, and darn it, you may have to loop that song, because I have an email I got to read from, darn it, where is it? From Eugene. Dude, I just bought a Dell Mini and the netbook case through your Amazon link. I had the sale all fired up on the Dell site and had already entered PayPal to pay for it. Then I thought about your haranguing us to use your Amazon link and gave it a try. For some reason, I was surprised to find the computer on Amazon. Not only did it save me $20, but the case selection was much better. And it's got virtually free shipping, $3.99 overnight versus $29.99 from Dell. And there doesn't appear to be any sales tax. I think the memory of your voice advising me to use your link to shop Amazon saved me a big chunk of change over buying it through Dell. So I'm going to share some of that savings back at you at a one-time donation. Now I'll be able to watch Chris Rosen's Netflix recommendations in their full 10.1-inch glory. That's from Eugene. So, I know, you're going to have to go through another song again. Yeah, how's that to annoy you motherfuckers? Sorry. So, folks, use that Amazon link. And, of course, justcoffee.coop. Great coffee, chocolate, and tea. All fair trade. It's a co-op. Nice. And 10% discount if you put majority in the coupon code box. All right, stick around for the post-show. You can call me at 646-257-3920 or I am at Majority FM. We'll be right back. Good show.